once a month, on a Thursday, we chat to researcher, author, blogger and public speaker in the field of diet and health, Dr. Zoe Harkham. Delighted to welcome her to the show today. Morning, Zoe.
Good morning, Bill. How are you doing?
Very good. It's a weird old time, isn't it?
It is indeed, isn't it? Yeah, probably the strangest time most of us will ever live through if we haven't lived through war.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And of course, we talk a lot when you're on about facts and about people being misled. And this really is a time when we desperately need the facts, don't we?
Yeah, we do. It's a very delicate time as well, actually, because whenever you're talking about deaths, inevitably you're talking about a very emotive subject. And for the person who's just lost a loved one, there's nothing more important in the world. And we're having deaths and cases and these numbers put on the front of newspapers. There are tallies on websites. It's the first thing that announces in the news. And it sort of emphasizes the trouble for people. We've never had something that actually most people don't think about and most people feel quite unable to think about. It's the toughest thing we ever have to talk about or face. And it's right in our face the whole time at the moment. And it really is a difficult time for everyone, but some people will be feeling it more than others, particularly those who have lost loved ones already in this very, very difficult time.
Absolutely. And partly to blame, of course, is social media, where the experts, in inverted commas, are anyone who happens to have a computer and can get on Facebook.
Yeah, I think, social media can be very good. I would be on it if it didn't have some good. I choose very carefully who I follow. I find it very useful for information at good times. So have you seen this paper? Have you seen the latest thing that's come out of Harvard, latest drug trial or whatever? It's very useful for that, and you can have private chats. But there's a lot of nastiness on social media. Yeah. And I think at the best of times, it shows you who's nice and who isn't nice. And unfortunately, at the worst of times, we realise even more strongly who is nice and who is not so nice.
Yeah.
And it becomes more polarised. So we have people making food parcels and going shopping for neighbours that perhaps they might not even know that well, but they know they need help. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got people hoarding 50 toilet rolls in their own house, not caring about anyone else. So
yeah, I've been saying for weeks it's bringing out the best in people, but it's also bringing out the worst in some people.
Yeah, totally, totally. And there have been, you've probably seen some of the internet funnies going around at the moment in the WhatsApp chats, and they're very much needed because humour is an absolute brilliant tool for helping us through difficult times. And there was one that I thought was quite funny that said live sport has, of course, all been cancelled, but if you want to see any boxing, just get down to your local supermarket. So it's many a true word spoken in jest, I think.
Yeah, there's an interesting point about that, and I've been banging on about this on my social media because it's something that people really should be very aware of, that it's great sending people stuff if you can kind of tell them, look, this is what this is and this is where I got it from, but there's so many people just forwarding random videos to people's phones on WhatsApp or Facebook, and a lot of these things are containing computer viruses, and we got enough viruses without worrying about them.
That's a very good point, actually. The lead, I check in with the BBC News just once in the evening. Again, I don't think it's helpful watching the news 24/7. That will only increase anxiety. But I check in at 6 each night, just for 5 minutes, just to see if there's any update, any new advice that we need to be aware of. And the BBC led yesterday on, please take care forwarding these things on WhatsApp. Not, they didn't actually mention from a computer virus point of view, but from a spreading misinformation point of view. So somebody gets the idea that, I don't know, a particular vitamin or a particular behavior, using a sauna, not using a sauna, vitamin D, not using vitamin D. They send those things around meaning to be helpful. No, I don't think many people are meaning to be harmful, but it might not be helpful. And for some people, particularly taking extra vitamin C, we've talked on this program before about the fact that when your body's got enough vitamin C, it will actually excrete it.
Yep.
So I've seen people saying, oh, you should be getting up to about 10 grams of vitamin C a day. And I'm like, whoa, are going to really harm someone there. Because for a lot of people, even taking 1 gram on one occasion, they'll have diarrhea the next morning.
Wow.
Other people will be able to take 3 or 4 grams no problem whatsoever. And in fact, it's a pretty useful tool if you've got someone who's constipated. They can find what we call their poo tolerance level of vitamin C. Quite a funny little phrase.
Interesting.
But take vitamin C to the point that your body is the passing, your bowels are going quite naturally and comfortably, and then you know that's a vitamin C intake that's good for you. But seriously, some of these high doses in someone who has never taken vitamin C, and diarrhea in an elderly person, and the imbalance that it can then create to the electrolytes, potassium, sodium, that's dangerous. So we have to be so careful at the moment.
I even saw the world's greatest medical expert, Donald Trump, giving drug advice that you should take a combination of two drugs.
Oh, bless him. Well, there's a blur as well, isn't there, at the moment, between what the politicians are saying and what the medical experts are saying. I did think about a couple of weeks ago when they started holding the daily conferences, now would be a good time to actually remove politicians from the equation and to put people like chief medical officers in charge of those briefings.
Yeah.
Now, there's a little caveat to that, because I'm a bit of a rebel at the best of times, and you'll know that I don't support official dietary advice.
Yep.
I actually think what we're seeing is that people with diabetes and obesity and heart disease particularly are succumbing to this virus in the way that people without obesity and diabetes are not. So we might need to have a look back on this and go back to those low-fat, high-carb guidelines and the other unintended consequences. But I don't think now is the time to be rebelling against official advice. However, there are some aspects of the official advice that aren't, I've been looking at masks,
yes,
for example.
Yes.
And there is very much a movement, and it seems to have been started out of Czechoslovakia. And just common sense says it doesn't make sense that we know that masks protect the healthcare workers, but they don't do anything to protect the general public. That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And someone asked me to take a look at the evidence, and I just finished it yesterday and posted an open post. And just looking at the evidence, which is what I do, systematic reviews, meta-analyses, Cochrane level, gold standard evidence, there is evidence that wearing a mask in healthcare workers and or in the general population does protect against transmission of viruses. So you do then get to the point of, I want to believe everything we're being told, but I also know that for many of the medical experts, they don't know everything. We cannot know everything. We have never been in this situation before. SARS was never this bad. Swine flu was never this bad. So we are working with the best info. But I understand that even the US CDC, Centers for Disease and Control, is now re-looking at the mask advice.
That's interesting, because I heard on the 11 o'clock news bulletin, there was a story that they were now going to reconsider their advice in the UK as well. But I guess the thing about masks is, Zoe, there's masks and there's masks, and then and then there's ways to take that mask off and put it on again without actually making it worse.
Yeah, no, totally. And that is the key point. And that is the beauty of this Czechoslovakian mask campaign. So if you go on my usual site, zoeharcombe.com, it's the most recent blog, and it's got links at the end. And I actually say in the blog, this is the video that you should watch. It's about 3¾ minutes long, beautifully made, very, very compelling. And the key message is, don't go buying surgical masks because the healthcare workers need them.
Yeah.
And that's probably been a key factor in why they haven't been encouraging us to go out and get masks. And I completely understand that. But the big campaign at the moment is make your own masks. And if you've got anyone in the local community, or you've got seamstresses, people with a sewing machine at home, Dr. Eric Westman posted a video of himself making a couple yesterday. Fantastic. And there are other things that work. So I've actually tried, I sleep with an eye mask, because it gives you a better quality of sleep.
Yes.
And if you just slide it down, it's got the loops on the back already. Just slide it down, and it actually covers your nose and mouth quite effectively.
What a good idea!
An everyday scarf. You can make them with handkerchiefs. If you've got any handkerchiefs at home, you can just tie a bit of string into them, make a little hole. People need to get creative, get the community going. Just don't go after the surgical masks, because we need those for the healthcare workers.
Very good.
And then, of course, as you've said, it's one of the UK Deputy Chief Medical Officer, one of her concerns with masks was that they can become contaminated.
Yep.
And then you touch them. But I mean, the first bit of common sense to say is, okay, if my mask became contaminated, that means a virus got on the outside of my mouth that would actually have got in my nose and mouth.
Mm.
Now, as a pretty healthy person, I actually think I've had it already, looking back over the last few weeks.
See, that's interesting. What makes you think that? I actually think that quite a lot of people I've seen in kind of December and January had what looks like the symptoms.
Well, do you know, I was chatting with my hubby at dinner one night, and I was saying, it was when Tom Hanks came out and said he had it. And then I think Trudeau's wife came out. I was chatting to Andy, and it's like, this is so bizarre. What a bizarre collection of people. And then the very next day, this chap tweeted, can anyone explain how a virus identified in Wuhan in December 2019 spread to the Canadian Prime Minister's wife, one of Hollywood's top actors, and his wife,
yeah,
a Premier League football manager, Arsenal, and a British Member of Parliament, Nadine Dorries, within 16 weeks while bypassing the majority of the rest of us?
Wow.
And of course, the answer is it didn't. Mm. It didn't bypass us. It can't have done. It cannot be in Prince Charles, Boris Johnson, Idris Elba, Tom Hanks, and Mrs. Trudeau while having bypassed you, me, and everyone else in the gatepost.
Yeah.
Why do I think I had it? Because we had a couple of people staying with us mid-February who had come directly from Australia via Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
The chap was very unwell, coughing, and I remember at the time thinking, oh, great, the last thing I need right now is flu or a head cold.
Oh, dear.
But it didn't feel like flu or a head cold. It felt like nothing I'd had before. I was still able to work throughout, which is not like flu. And I can remember one or two occasions of flu in my adult life, and you can't work. You're in bed for 4 to 5 days. I wasn't in bed, but I was having early nights. A couple of nights I thought, oh, I really should go in the spare room because I'm coughing. And then there were a couple of nights my hubby was coughing, and I thought, well, you should be in the spare room. But we stayed together. But the single biggest observation, both of us are pretty fit, and walking up a flight of stairs was exhausting. You get to the landing and it'd be kind of like, whoa, I just feel like I haven't exercised for 10 years.
Yes.
And our normal little gentle half an hour walk around the village, a couple of not too bad ups and downs. And after about 5 minutes of trying to resume that walk, I just said to Andy, do you know what? I'm exhausted. I'm not breathing properly.
Wow.
And that's what made me realise, no, this wasn't flu. It wasn't a cold. The timing was perfect. The contact was perfect. I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty confident that we've both been exposed already.
That's interesting. And Zoe, if you are showing mild symptoms, we heard Boris Johnson say and Prince Charles that their symptoms were mild. Would you always, for example, have a fever? Is a fever not the body trying to fight off something?
No, absolutely. I mean, it is one of the most, so I looked at the academic references, the papers are being published on this fantastically rapidly, and looked at some of the academic references. And in the original, the very first paper that was done in The Lancet on this, on the very first 41 patients identified, 40 out of 41 patients had a fever, and 31 out of 41 had a cough.
Wow.
We didn't check our temperature just because that's not the kind of thing we would normally do. We just didn't even really think about it. It's only when we're looking back on it, we think, oh my goodness, everything fits. So you can have a fever, but it might not be so striking. I happen to have a low body temperature almost all the time.
Oh, okay.
So mine is normally about 97 point something, not 98.4. So for me to have a normal temperature is actually a high temperature.
Ah.
And other people may be in the same boat. Not everyone has got a thermometer. Some people are getting very mild symptoms. There seems to be something in the degree of exposure that you might have had.
Yes.
So imagine the terrible scenario that you're a medic working in Wuhan, so you're very close to the source of the virus.
Yeah.
And we know that the virus can mutate, but that also means it can weaken the further it gets away from the host. Imagine the terrible scenario that your mask was breached and a patient was coughing and spluttering all over you because you were trying to put some equipment on them or help them in some way, you could have a lot of droplets get into your system very, very quickly. That is so different to, let's say, someone who has touched a rail on a public transport and the virus has been on it for a couple of hours.
Yes.
And you happen to touch it, and then a couple of hours later you happen to touch your face, not even your nose or your mouth. You know, there are degrees of exposure, and that is now also thought to be a factor in terms of how serious it is when somebody actually gets the virus.
That makes total sense. How interesting to look at it like that. And at what point should people really push the panic button in terms of symptoms?
Yeah, so very, very good point. For a lot of people, they'll start feeling unwell. It might feel like no more than a cold or a bit of flu, or just feeling a bit unusual or a bit out of breath. Some may have the more classic symptoms of the cough, the fever, and the respiratory problems, difficulty breathing. For most people, the virus seems to be overcome in about 5 to 7 days.
Right.
So in most people, at about 5 or 6 days, you should start feeling a little bit better. If at that point, that's when it seems to turn. It can turn earlier, but that's when it can seem to turn in people who might be a bit higher risk. If you then start developing serious breathing problems, if you find you couldn't hold a normal conversation like this without gasping for breath, even a few words without gasping for breath,
right,
at any stage in the illness, if that's what you're experiencing, that's when the advice is you are now entitled to call one of the helplines or emergency lines or your local GP. But if someone is at the point that they are completely struggling to breathe, then obviously it's a 999 situation.
Sure.
And the whole point of the strategy of trying to stop the spread, this flattening the curve motto that we've been talking about, is very much aimed so that when that person needs the emergency treatment, the emergency services are able to deal with that person.
Absolutely.
Now, yeah, they are getting to the tragic circumstance when you know if you've got somebody coming into hospital who's over 90, who might perhaps have diabetes or have known heart disease or even cancer. Unfortunately, the health authorities then know this is someone for whom the prognosis is not good.
Right.
And that's when there's no easy way for them to be working with the relatives, but apparently relatives have just been fantastic, saying we understand, and if it wasn't going to be this, it was going to be flu next season or whatever. Or we've been worried about their heart for a few years. And in fact, one of the loveliest stories I've come across in all of this was apparently a priest in Italy, where they've been very badly hit and have had to make these very, very difficult decisions of, does the 90-year-old get the respirator, or does the 30-year-old, who may have had a high exposure and is unusually struggling with the virus, who gets the ventilator?
Yeah.
And a priest, apparently, a 72-year-old priest, apparently gave up his ventilator to a much younger person, somebody about half of his age, and said, look, no, I've had a good life, so do the right thing.
Amazing.
And there's been other stories of that, older people realising that they're not going to pull through. And a lot of the doctors are trying to have the conversations with the family to say, look, people are spending about 2 to 3 weeks on a ventilator. The ones that then do pull through, it's pretty unpleasant.
Yeah.
So the ones that pull through, it's fantastic, because they go on to have hopefully many, many good years of happy, healthy life. But for a 92-year-old perhaps, who they will know, this is what medics know, this is why they go to medical school, this is why they have experience like this, they know the odds of a particular person pulling through. And why put them through that for the last 2 to 3 weeks of their life? If they actually know the chances of this person pulling through at the other end is perhaps 1 in 100 or 1 in 10. I don't know the odds, but these guys do know.
Difficult choices, really difficult choices.
It's really tough, isn't it? And this is why, I don't know if you're doing it in Spain, but in the UK, we have this thing now where we clap, we stand out on our doorsteps.
Yeah.
And clap for the healthcare workers.
We do. The Spanish are doing it way better than the UK, believe me.
Oh, that's lovely. I've seen you guys singing on balconies and doing Keep Fit in the street and everything. It's fantastic.
There was a great video somebody posted of an Italian singing beautiful opera from the balcony and everybody applauding. And then there was a Spaniard singing the most incredible flamenco. And then they cut to a guy in the UK leaning over his balcony, drunk, singing Bohemian Rhapsody out of tune.
Brilliant. That just sort of sums up Europe, I think, doesn't it?
Certainly does.
Oh dear, what do I...
Well, listen, yeah. Zoe, as always, it's been lovely to talk to you. You take care of yourself, and hopefully next time we talk in a month's time, we'll be over the worst of this and we can start
looking forward.
It certainly would be absolutely lovely.
Yeah, take care too. Catch you soon.
Yeah, zoeharkham.com is your website if people want to go and find out. There's loads more information on there. All right, Zoe, take care.